So.
All right, guys, I'm going to start talking. I didn't really prepare anything, but as you guys know just from me walking around, I can talk about anything for as long as I want. So I think the big thing that I find most attractive about what we've been able to start doing here is this idea of resonate, you know, the idea that I really believe we all send off our own power. And, you know, when you meet somebody special, like my wife, you resonate, you get that chill in your spine. And that to me is what I'm constantly in search of. I just got one. And that's one of those things that if you can start understanding that that's what's important in your life, that little resonation, that finding something that's real, because that to me is, you know, the universe, God or whatever is telling you, this is something special you need to pay attention to. So if you meet somebody, you know, like your wife, or you hold your child for the first time, or, you know, you meet a whole group of people, your body reacts to you. I mean, you get little chills down your spine. You know, a lot of people tend to get it with music. So music is a very powerful motivator. You know, the actual, playing of instruments, you know, I heard a really cool thing. I've been looking into, Buddhism. You know, I was talking about Buddhism earlier. And that the sitar, you know, that they play all the music, if the string is too loose, it doesn't make music. And if the string is too tight, it'll break. And it has to be perfect in order to resonate. And that's the idea of kind of in life. You know, if you're too loose with your life, you tend to not do anything. And if you're too tight with your life and you try to hold on to everything, you tend to break at some point because you're too tight. So the idea is to find a middle path in your life, find something that really resonates with you. And I spent a great deal of my life being too tight. I mean, you couldn't get any more conservative, Marine, hardcore Republican than me. And man, I came from a very shark-like environment. I mean, my father is a car dealer in New Jersey, so you can imagine what that's like. My mom is a contractor that she's, you know, 5'2", 100 pounds soaking wet, but she can bark down, you know, 6'4" union guys in Jersey City, if I'll get to tell you that story. And I did what society, my parents, and everybody else thought was the right thing to do, which was to be tight. So I went to Boston College. I went to the Marine Corps after Boston College. I mean, who goes in the Marines after they go out of, you know, Boston College? Well, I do, because that's what, a tight path was to do these things. And then, you know, going into business, I wanted to become the best car dealer out there. And while everybody thinks car dealers are, you know, scuzzy business, it is, you know, especially in New Jersey. But my business was a family business, and we constantly outdid, you know, some of these big major auto malls, because I ran the business and I ran it like it was my personal business. And I had relationships with my customers like I've tried to establish with you guys. And that led me to a point where at 31 years old, I was a millionaire and I was empty. And I looked at my parents and I saw that they were empty. And I looked at my partners and I saw that they were empty. And that bothered me very much. And I ended up meeting my wife, Dora, here, and I started to feel something in me again, that vibration that you know, you're starting to resonate with somebody. And she brought to me a lot of softness and got me from being hard, this hard path, to being much more in the middle. And that resonation that I started having with her softened me up to stop being so aggressive, hard, and demanding, and all the stuff that the Marines teach us to, you know, improvise, adapt, and overcome, and kick ass, and kick doors. And I mean, I love that environment. I thrived in that environment. But I realized that that does not lead to something that resonated with me, because I wasn't a shark. I wasn't this fighter. That didn't do anything for me. So when I met my wife, it started to break down that wall, and I started to resonate with her. And I didn't have a word for it. I just knew that I liked being with her. And as a result, my family did not like my wife. Now, you guys have all met her. She's a very nice lady. I love her. But she did not resonate with my family. And it caused a lot of strife because she was not the business, you know, role that, that fit into my parents' life. And the reason why I'm telling you all this, because I want you to know where I come from, because it's one thing to think about person's thoughts, but I think it's so much more to know about the context which these thoughts were formed. So that's why I'm kind of getting into all this, even though it's, very personal. but as this relationship developed, having this new life inside of me caused a rift within my family, and I started to see where I wanted to go with my life. And I knew I wanted to be with her, and we did. We ended up getting married, and caused a lot of, again, strife with my parents. I didn't know when I came back from my honeymoon if I was going to have a job. That's how much problem it had. We actually had to cancel our wedding 6 weeks before at my parents' house because of what my mom had done with her. But we kept going forward. And that is one of the biggest things I could tell you. No matter how scared you are, keep going towards that vibration. Keep going towards that thing that resonates with you. Because that's the bigger force leading you to what you're meant to be. And those that don't follow that vibration tend to live lives of quiet desperation. That Henry David Thoreau quote that I keep using: most men live lives of quiet desperation and go to bed and go to the grave with their heart still, or their song still inside of them. And that to me is the saddest thing that could possibly happen, is that you don't find whatever that vibration is in your life. Because really, what was your life all worth? I'm going to look at my parents' grave one day and see that they had millions of dollars, but they never had a relationship with me. They've never known their grandchildren. And it's tough to know that, but that's the life that they choose. And I'm going to get into dealing with that kind of personality later, because it's a tough thing, I'll tell you. But as I went through this relationship with my wife, and seeing that now I have my family who's very wealthy, very respected. I mean, everybody's like, oh, the Duanes. But I knew it was all empty, because I would see them at home, and they'd be sitting there in the big fancy chair watching TV with no one around them, no one calling them, no one talking to them, because the only people that they would talk to were business people. And then it was a shark game for them. It was like, how can I get the most out of this deal? And, if I do this and sue this guy and do that, that's the way that they think. And that to me is not something I wanted to do, because that breaks other people down and causes tension and dissension. And when you try to change the outside world to make you happy, it doesn't work, because all that does is make somebody say, well, you're doing this to me, I'm going to do this to you. So this Occupy Wall Street, this Tea Party movement, this, running for office thing, that's somebody, this is the consciousness of you changing the outside world to make you feel good. Okay, it'll never work. No matter how smart you are, no matter how much you believe in all this stuff, no matter how much effort you put into believing what we all believe in, it'll never work. Trust me, I've tried. I'm probably the most eloquent guy out there that can change anybody's mind. I can give you all the thoughts, I can give you all the facts, I can give you the passion, I can do all that. It'll never work. It's a fool's errand. The only way, and this is why we're here today, the only way that the world can change is if we change, okay? You have to change yourself to change the world, not change the world to change yourself, okay? And that's why I teach, logic. That's why I teach leaderless resistance. That's why I teach, you educating yourself. That's why I teach that you guys are the smart ones. I'm just here transmitting this stuff, but you guys are all capable of doing what I'm doing, okay? You just have to feel this vibration inside of you to have the courage to do what I've done. And speaking of courage, so I see that my family's got all this wealth, and I wanted to see where we got all this money from. I mean, 31 years old, I'm a millionaire on paper. I didn't know what this was. I was, a kid. And that's when I started discovering that, what money was, okay? And I learned that money is not money, it's debt. All of our money out there is debt, and you guys all know this. And those that get access to the debt first are the ones that make the most money. So the name of the game is, in this paradigm, create as much debt as you want, and you'll be rich. You'll be the conduit of debt, and you'll be rich. And that's why all this power flows to Washington and D.C., or D.C. and New York, because that's all they do is create debt. you know, bonds and stocks and offerings and all that other stuff. That's what they do, and that's why all the money keeps going to there. So as a car dealer, well, what do car dealers do? They don't sell cars. They create debt on a massive scale. I mean, I would create $40 million worth of debt a month. Of course I'm going to make money. Of course my family's going to make money, okay? Because no one's walking in with a bag of silver and saying, I'm going to buy a car with this value that I have here. No, they sign a contract and say, I'm going to pledge my hard work, sweat, and labor over the next 5 years, 7 years, and pay, you know, 9, 10, you know, whatever percent interest. And over that time period, they would pay that off, okay? But for me, I get my check the next day. I've already taken your wealth in the future today. Because as soon as that check's contract's cashed, the bank does what? Monetizes the debt, sells it out to the market, and pays me whatever profit I had on that contract. So I, when I realized that, I'm like, wow, what I'm doing here is pretty scummy. This doesn't resonate with me. As much as I really love the car business. I mean, I really love the car business. I love cars. I love people. I like the whole business of it. But what it has morphed into is disgusting to me. And then I started thinking, well, really, I love America. You know, I love the Marine Corps. I would love to, you know, I really enjoy that. I enjoyed my college time. But what they have all morphed into because of debt is disgusting. I don't think that we should be fighting 10 years of needless, senseless wars over there. I think it's disgusting what we've been turned into. I just read about an Army Ranger that was on his 14th tour and just died. I mean, 14 tours. What are we doing with this guy? And for what? Who does that serve? Does that serve him? Does that serve his family, his child? So that bothers me to no end. But once I've discovered that, what we were doing was creating debt, I realized, well, we're in the middle of probably the biggest debt bubble to date, which was the housing market. So in 2005, Dora is 7.5 months pregnant with our first child, and we're at the doctor's office, and I've probably talked about this a couple times. And I'm sitting in the waiting room, and I'm, you know, nervous and stuff like that, and there's this Time Magazine article, and I keep putting it up on the site. But, man, that thing sticks in my brain. I don't never read Time Magazine, but, you know, you're in the doctor's office. And it had this picture of the cartoon guy hugging the house going, you know, why we love housing. And I read the article, and they were all kids my age that were millionaire paper guys just like me. You know, they're millionaires. And why? Because they had debt. They were creating debt. They flipped houses. They rehabbed houses. They did all this. And I said, this is insane. I said, I now have the context of understanding what is really going on, what the world is without, you know, without the media spin, without the, you know, the economic, you know, baloney that they put out there saying that this can go on forever and, you know, housing's great and all that other stuff. And she's 7.5 months pregnant, okay? And I say, I'm on my laptop. I get home from that day. I get on my laptop. I read some articles, and I'm like, what did I do? I closed it up and I said, we're selling the house. Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot to left out that point. So we have a child on the way. All right. So I have to get into this a little bit. Yeah, I had a little home. So, oh, yeah. So I had plans to. My house was so small. I mean, it was a 1900, 800 square foot home. It was literally a 20 by 20 square building, two floors. That was it. One bathroom, two bedrooms, no garage, on this little teeny sliver of land, and it was, you know, 100 year old home, and it was beautiful. It was a, you know, arts and crafts home. You know, it's got not drywall. It's got the plaster. It had all hardwood floors, and I had done real, I'm a little queer when it comes to decorating, so I had painted all the rooms and did all this nice stuff, and got the house all nicely set up for being a bachelor, and then, you know, in comes Dora, and we end up getting married and having a child. So I realized I couldn't have a kid inside this house. It was too tight for us. So we started with getting plans, because that's what everybody else was doing. Everybody else was putting on, you know, these huge additions onto their homes and doing all this other stuff, because that's what the collective you know, felt was the right thing to do. It wasn't probably necessarily the best thing. So we started looking at it, and like just the costs in New Jersey during this housing bubble, and then our neighbors, remember our neighbors? They did do this. They spent 2 years doing this. They were out of their house while the construction. Yeah, they had lawsuits with the contractors. It was just a mess. And again, something wasn't resonating with me. And then when I saw this Time Magazine article, I'm like, oh, this is, I got to get out of here. So that's what we, yeah. And again, this is one of the other powerful stories I want to tell you is that if somebody in your family, I'm not going to say any, believes a lot in this stuff, listen to them. You know, even if it's not something you're into, just listen to them. I could not have done all the stuff that I have done without her support. If she was fighting me, I know I would have caved in at some point. But every one of these crazy decisions that I've done, she's supported me. Maybe she didn't quite understand why, you know, but she did support me and she didn't fight me. You know, even in the things that, I mean, trust me, try selling a house with a 7.5 month pregnant wife, you know, on a whim's notice. So that's what we did. We put the house up on the market in, I don't know, June, I think. And it was sold within a month or so. And just to kind of put these valuations on, because when I tell the story, you know, in 2005, people were like, "You're crazy selling a home. That's ridiculous. You'll never be able to buy another home. You're you know, how could you do that with your wife?" I mean, it was like I committed some mortal sin to the people I told, and these are people who knew me. You know, it's, you know, my family, all business partner, everybody was just like, "You're an idiot for selling your home. You know, property's going to go up forever. We have land banks. We're smart." But let's put this valuation on it. So now we've known that we had this huge housing crash, and you know, maybe from Ohio and Pennsylvania, these numbers are going to seem ridiculous. But this little 100-year-old, 800 square foot house, no garage, one bathroom, upstairs house, sold for $435,000. I was the smallest home in the neighborhood, okay? And my parents' house was a 10,000 square foot home, and it was probably worth $2.5 million. And they were, you know, over the hill from me. But, you know, I looked at it and I'm like, $435,000. Well, I only bought it for $200,000 5 years ago, so it can't be worth that much, right? I mean, it just can't. But it sold, and I had a bidding war. And actually, the couple that won, I wish now didn't, because there was a remember that real the divorce lady that she was bitter. But the nice couple wrote Dora a letter and said that we've been in an apartment, we wanted to buy this house, and so we were like, oh, let's give it to the young couple. Now I wish I'd give it to the divorce lady, but yeah, I mean, that's not our choice. So all we can do is deal with the cards that you're dealt with. So I mean, it's, you know. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Literally, we're like, hey, we need to stay here.
Yeah, by the time we had cleaned out the house to make it look presentable to sell, I was like, I want to stay here. This is great. You know, but when you move your life in there and you got bins and stuff, it was just too small. Oh, so yeah. So what we ended up doing was, again, ridiculous prices, even thinking about it, especially now that we live out here. So we went moved into this, like, Hollywood-like lot community. It was a... Yeah, it was. Yeah. It looked like a Hollywood set,
yeah.
But it was a rental place, and we got a 3-bedroom, you know, rental condo, and it, what was it like 32.50 a month to rent this place. But this is New Jersey, guys. I mean, this is New Jersey at its height of. I mean. The area I lived in, like the town I worked in, was Summit, New Jersey. It had John Corzine. You guys have heard from him. Goldman Sachs, dirtbag, governor, dirtbag. He lived in Summit. He didn't even rank. His estate was worth, I don't know, $400 million at one point. He didn't rank in the top 25 richest people in Summit. Okay? There's billionaires in Summit. And Summit's this weird community because it was one of the only train stations in New Jersey that took a direct line to Midtown Manhattan. So all the bankers, lived in Summit. So I lived in a world that was even more beyond ridiculous than anybody else, because I would have, you know, guys coming in motorcycle shirts and stroking me checks for $45,000 out of their checking account to go buy a Wrangler because they want to take it on the weekend. You know, like just, you know, buying, you know, nanny cars. That was the other thing. We sold Grand Cherokees not to the rich people. We sold them to their nannies. Like, that's the world that we lived in. So my process of starting to wake up from this world, because most people don't, let's be honest here, most people don't wake up to reality until they've hit rock bottom. I did the opposite. I woke up from reality at being at the top. You know, most people have to lose everything and go through anger and denial and depression and all these phases, and then wake up one day and go, wow, well, maybe I'm responsible for this because I took on too much debt, or I was in the wrong job, or I was doing something that didn't resonate. I woke up from this being like, you couldn't get any higher than me. I mean, it was like, it was great. But I realized it was such an empty existence in my life. I mean, I without her, I would have been miserable. I would have been very successful, but miserable. Because in the car business, you have 5 good days a year. Okay? Maybe 4 good days a year. And it's the end of the month that you did better than the last year. And in the car business, it's very, you know, cyclical. And, you know, you get 4 good months out of the year that you make a ton of money. And then the rest of the time, it's like, oh, my God, I'm going to go out of business. What am I going to do with all this inventory? I got employees and, you know, property taxes and all this other stuff. And, you know, those 4 days a year, you hit it great. But I tell you what, the next day, what was it like?
Can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead. Right. And then try valuing yourself as a son when your dad only values that, you know? So try bringing it up. So what did I do? I tap danced as hard as I could to make him happy. And I realized that when I met her, I didn't need to tap dance to make people happy. They're either happy or they're not. I either resonate with them or not. And then for me to try to logically talk them through, or, you know, one of the last things I did for my dad was buy him a dog. I thought that would soften him up. I said, my mom's a hard ass, so let's get him a puppy. So, again, another. I try to relate this, like, because I can tell you a lot of you are right now are going, it's impossible that you don't have communication with your parents. You look like a nice guy. Dora looks like a nice girl. You know, it's impossible. You know, people don't get it. And I tell you, unless you've ever met my parents, if you ever dealt with a true, you know, social predator out there, you will never understand. But going through this thing, I relate my story much like Luke Skywalker with Darth Vader. So we have Luke Skywalker, who's the heir apparent and got all these special powers and stuff. And Darth Vader's there. He rules the Empire, and he's this big guy. And trust me, my dad's pretty imposing. He's got this really cool silver hair and, you know, big suits. And he's always, everything's perfectly coiffed, and he always looks good. And here I was, you know, Luke Skywalker trying to say, I know you got it in you, Darth Vader, you can come to the good side, and, you know, I see the good in you, and all that other stuff. And I would try that over and over again. And I tell you what, at the end of the day, you know, the Death Star blew up and I got out of town. So that was pretty much the only way you can go about doing this. It's a fool's errand to try to change people. You can't. I can't change my wife. I love her to death. I cannot change her. You can't, even your children, you know, try changing your children. I mean, if you got kids that are grown up, they are who they are. Your only job is to hug them as much as you can while you got them. And, you know, to hopefully show them something that has value. Wow, this is going pretty good considering I didn't have any of this right now. So when we went through this process, we had sold the house, we had rented, and now began my bargaining phase, okay? I didn't go through an anger phase. My anger phase was, wow, the Federal Reserve's privately owned, and they fund all these wars, and we got all these corrupt politicians. That sucks. Oh, well. So I went into the bargaining phase, and my bargaining phase was to try to convince my millionaire parents, my millionaire partners, and anybody else who would possibly listen to me, customers. I mean, can you imagine going in to go buy a Wrangler? And all right, so listen, the Federal Reserve is this privately owned bank, and listen, I just want my Wrangler, and I want to go off and, you know, have fun. So I spent 3 years, and that was my research period. That's where I read, I don't know, 240 books in probably a year and a half. I mean, I was insane. It would be Amazon book boxes coming in on a weekly basis, and I would read through Creature of Jekyll Island in a few days. I'd read through the Rise and Collapse of Rome, Atlas Shrugged. I mean, I read 1,000-page books. I've read Warren Buffett's A Permanent Value. It's a book this big. But I kept reading all this stuff, trying to make sense of what I had this epiphany that debt was money. You know, what is that? And it led me into everything. And that's where I started to see that all this stuff out there, it is so important, and yet there's nobody talking about this. And then those that did talk about it, they only focused on one thing, like G. Edward Griffin. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve and money, but then we don't talk about false flag events. We don't talk about the psychology of it. We don't talk about the emotional. We don't talk about the educational. We don't talk about the spiritual. We don't talk about all these other things that are out there, and they all play together. It's all about controlling you, and not even controlling you controlling yourself. Because that's what we're bred to do. We're bred to be our own worst enemies, to serve a collective, to do what society wants you to do, not what's best for you, not what resonates with you, okay? So I went through this process of learning all these things, and if I have one gift, I can absorb a ton of information, and I can process. If you want to talk about somebody who thinks logically, that's all I do. I can take anything. You put me into a business paradigm, I will, that's what I do. I sort through every single function. Like this, I'll get a little ahead of myself, but this business I was in with this real estate investing, teaching people how to invest in foreclosed properties, our friend Doris' friend's husband started this company teaching people how to invest in foreclosed properties because he did it. And he had the smart idea of actually kind of blueprinting how to go about doing it, hitting all these, the county clerk courts, finding out who's foreclosed, getting to the homeowner if they're in distress, and arranging the financing, and all this stuff. And that's what he did. He taught people how to invest in foreclosed property. So, when we moved here, I was like, well, that's going to be a booming business now that the home business ended. But he created a ton of mess by starting this business, and he sold a lot of these informational products, and he had no clue. One of my first day at work, I had email complaints of 450 email complaints about people saying their credit card was messed up and all that other stuff. So I came from a brick and mortar business that revolved around buildings, cars, and employees, and now I'm in this computer world. I didn't know what a hyperlink was 3 years ago, folks. I did not know. I had an email account that I never used. I'm not computer savvy. When I went on the internet, I would go to MSNBC and click on there. I didn't know about other websites out there. And I got involved in this internet company, and now all of a sudden I'm doing video rendering and web graphics and all sorts of stuff. And it's because I have the ability to observe, logically think about it, and rhetoric. And that's the thing that's missing with most people out there, is that they're only able to do what they're told. And I realized that with my employees. I'd be like, wow, selling cars is really easy. You just learn all this stuff, and you talk to people, and you get to know them, and you find out what their needs and wants are, and then you go out and you go find the car for them. Wow, computer graphics is really easy. What you do is you do this, you do that. And I realized in my hiring process, whenever I would hire people, I would always assume everybody has the same kind of set of skills that I have. And they're not. And it got sad to me that I couldn't even find anybody who could do the most basic things without me babysitting them. It was frustrating, because I was always a self-motivator, self-starter. But my ability to process all this information allowed me to now look at these things that are big. And I realized that it's big because the world runs on it, but it's also big because it is what I am, okay? So the world is this scene out there, what's in the newspaper, what's, we hear all these statements. That's what they're trying to tell you what it is, but that doesn't resonate with me, okay? whatever Washington, D.C. does doesn't resonate with me. Wall Street doesn't resonate with me. You guys resonate with me. She resonates with me. My children resonate with me. You know, that's what's important. So when I went through this process of learning all this stuff, I started to logically put through so I could help understand how the world works. And of course, most people started with money. I think if I were to ask 90% of the people I ever woke up, they're always like the dollar. You know, that to me is like the one thing that really gets them, okay? Understanding that it's dead, understanding it's fiat, understanding it's privately owned, understanding that, you know, that thing, that really gets them. And then when I started looking to the dollar, then I started looking into wars, then I started looking into politics, then I started looking into, you know, healthcare. I mean, that's another, you know, nutrition and all this stuff. And then, you know, realizing that I have friends, I've had two friends now that have cancer at 35 years old. What kind of world is that? Okay. It's a world that's poisoning us. I mean, there's no other way of explaining it. God didn't just create all this, you know, cancer. It didn't just happen now. It's because of what we're eating and what we're consuming, what we're surrounding ourselves with. And that's part of a paradigm that I hope is going to end. So when I went through all this stuff, I would, you know, start on, I got a little tech savvy. I went onto a message board. So I went to, have you ever heard of this site called goldismoney.info? Okay. It was a really cool forum that blew up. Were you on it?
Not very much, but I had been on it.
Okay. It was a really cool site because it was the only site that I had known where individuals were talking with each other, okay? And it was a forum that was based on, you know, basically silver and gold, and I was attracted to that. And I realized with people talking to each other, ideas start flowing, and people were resonating with each other because I was never attracted to gurus. I was because I'd consistently been let down throughout my entire life, whether it was a political figure, you know, like I liked Ross Perot. He seemed to resonate with me when I was a kid. You know, I was only 18 years old, and that little Texas guy really got me going because he was different than what these other guys were doing. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I wish we had all listened to him because that giant sucking sound is, you know, he everybody laughed at that guy, but I tell you what, that giant sucking sound, we're all living with that right now. And it's funny how there's a quote from Voltaire that, we're a wretched species that throws stones at people who, you know, show a new path. And I think that's, I totally messed that up, but the idea is that anybody who speaks differently outside that collective, we're trained almost impulsively, tribally, to throw stones at them. Because in our primal need, our safety is the group. We all know that we're weak individuals. We can never survive on our own, right? Like that's kind of like this, you know, caveman mentality. You have to be in a tribe in order to survive. And anybody who goes outside that tribe, well, you're weakening the tribe by making it that way. But I think we've progressed to a point now with the ability of having silver and firearms that you can pretty much survive on your own if you really wanted to. You know, maybe it's not a happy existence or not, but you can. So now it's probably a little easier for individuals to come out and say things that are, you know, outside the collective's thought. So when we went on to this goldismoney.info or whatever it was, I realized that there was a lot of information out there, okay? And I learned a lot, and I started going into different websites and reading more books, and I'd find, you know, all these mental fireworks. That's the other thing that I kept chasing after was these, wow, that's a great idea. You know, wow, oh, that now starts going over with this idea, and then all of a sudden, a light starts shining in my head where things make sense. And I guess, you know, enlightenment is a good word for it because you do become enlightened. And yet most of our lives, we're living a very dark, shallow, closed, narcissistic, consumeristic, you know, me. And, you know, your world becomes smaller and smaller the further you go down that road. And I'd seen the end of the road. It's my parents. I mean, guy's got an 80-foot, $2 million yacht. And it's just him and his miserable wife, and no grandkids and no things, no friends. I mean, they never had friends. That's one thing I told them. I said, it's weird. Don't you guys have any friends? Well, we have each other. Yeah, they have each other, all right. So I knew that world, that way of life was not something that resonated with me. I'd seen the end of that tunnel, and I wanted to search for something else. And, you know, she's been a big help to lighten this part. But originally, it started with my mind. I realized that I needed to change myself, not the outside world. I needed to change myself in order for my world to become free. So through this process of setting off all these mental fireworks and starting to put things together, I started organizing all this stuff so it made sense in my mind. I can't sleep until something makes sense to me, okay? And I will research, I will think, I will, you know, if somebody's challenges me, I encourage debate, you know, like I don't censor any comments on the blog. You know, if somebody says something stupid, you know, you guys tend to jump over them before I do, but I encourage it because, you know, in fact, I think we had a pretty good debate about the gun control. We had this guy, Prudentis, from Germany, who said that our gun laws are too lax. And, you know, I didn't censor him. They had a good back and forth. And I think he said that, you know, it was a good point that you guys brought up. And maybe I was a little critical. And that's the way it should be. We shouldn't be, you know, and I try to tell people, don't attack people. Don't throw stones at somebody just because they're different. We should be the first ones not to throw stones because we're the ones that usually get the stones thrown at us. So when somebody comes into our little community and starts, you know, throwing stones, you know, you get the guys going, you know, like this Iran thing, this Iran article. They're like, you know, well, you guys are going to be, you know, as soon as the Muslims come and kill you, you'll feel bad. Or, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like, who do I have to fear more? If we look at evil as being somebody doing something to me personally without my will, somebody interfering in my life, I have more to fear from the government than I do from some cave dwellers out in Afghanistan.
Yeah, our government set them off to begin with.
Yeah, well, yeah, and then you can get into that deeper debate, but with those people, you're not going to get there. They're going to be like, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. I only have videotape of Zbigniew Brzezinski saying, you know, that this is our Mujahideen. He admitted 6 months, it was actually 1979 that they started funding the Mujahideen, not 1980, and that it was a plan, you know, the Anglo-American plan. So I can get into that type of stuff. And you guys can go learn all that on your own. So as I go through this mental fireworks, I really started becoming enlightened. I really felt, this sounds queer, but, you know, this vibration, this light, I feel these things. I mean, they're not, you know, I don't have lightning bolts coming in my hand. I feel like I got fire sometimes coming in my veins because I get so passionate about it and I really believe in this stuff. But you can spark all this stuff because you can start finding truth is what does it. Like whenever, you know, like some of the best comedy, you know, I listen to Bill Hicks and George Carlin. If you ever notice, the things that they say that you laugh at aren't necessarily funny, but they're true. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's the stuff that really gets an audience. Like they'll say something and you laugh at it, but you realize it's not that funny. Like a lot of their humor is very morbid. I mean, you listen to, you know, not the more popular stuff from Hicks and Carlin, but like Life is Worth Dying with George Carlin. I mean, it's a morbid thing that he's talking about, but he's really touching on the dark side of humanity and what we're, you know, capable of degenerating into and how interesting he finds it because it's them that's doing it, not me. I like observing. But that's what, when you find that truth, when you find that spark, that's when you start to become more interested in this stuff, and you need to start pursuing it. So when I went through this process of sparking and doing all this stuff, I started putting all this information down. I would underline every single book that I ever read. If you guys don't do that when you read books, do it. You know, star it, underline it, fold pages, because you never know what you're going to end up doing. And that's what I ended up doing. I had 250 books of just ragtag, underlined, starred, you know, all this type stuff. And I put all this information together, and that's when I got done with my bargaining phase. I you know, tried to convince my parents to sell all these properties. From 2005 to 2008, I talked to them about, gave all my partners copies of Creature from Jekyll Island. My Christmas gift for all my employees was Creature from Jekyll Island. Gee, thanks, boss. I really could have used $100 bonus. Instead, you give me this boring book on the Federal Reserve. So, but that's the kind of guy I am, I guess. Yeah, I try. So I would have these debates with them because to me, I felt that it was ridiculous that I had more silver than my father, even though he was worth so much more than me. I said, Dad, it's ridiculous. You can give up, you know, nothing out of your fortune. Get some silver just as insurance. I said, you know, you don't think you're going to get in a car accident, but you wear a seatbelt, don't you? If what I'm saying, you know, is even a 2% chance in your mind that it could happen, why wouldn't you have some? So he did finally buy 10,000 ounces. I got him to buy 10,000 ounces, which to him was basically shut up for me to get me to get off his back. So he bought that, and I then put into his mind that he should sell some of these properties. So the Summit dealership in that very rich, affluent area, we had 7 acres in that town. And so now we're in the super rich town inside the thing, right next to the train station, which I told you is the main reason. So he had a deal with Pulte Homes for $35 million. Okay. And that was, I don't know, 2005, 6, 7, somewhere around there. And it had to get all these approvals and stuff like that. So when I was in activated after 9/11, I was in Kosovo, and that's when I started thinking about property and stuff like that. I put it in his mind, because my mom was a construction person, why wouldn't we put up apartment buildings and rent them in this very affluent town than selling cars? I mean, you make tons more money doing that, right? So I had talked to them about it. They had put plans out there, and they realized that if they developed themselves, we didn't have the money. I mean, you need, you know, a lot of money, a lot of capital to do that stuff, and that's not something he had. So he went to Pulte Homes, and they ended up, there was like three builders that were all building on this, and Pulte is the biggest one out there. So that was like 2005, 2006, and, you know, these would drag on for years. If you've ever been in front of a planning board, even for something inane, it's like, so they would drag on, and then you have to get engineers and stuff like that. So as this is dragging on, I'm like, the dollar's going to collapse any moment. Daddy, you got to sell this stuff. I mean, it's going to go tomorrow. I've sold my house. I buy guns. And so, you know, I really thought that I was like, once it's amazing. Once you see how corrupt the system is, you're like, how could this possibly exist anymore? This should collapse tomorrow. It's a complete fraud. Well, it exists because 99% of the other people think that that is reality. And they stay inside that reality, and they provide the blood and energy and sweat and tears for that, and they sacrifice for it. They don't realize it, but they're empowering it, okay? So that's why it exists. That's why the dollar hasn't collapsed. That's why the euro hasn't collapsed, because 99% of the people out there are going to do it, okay? But at some point, there's going to be a trigger where it's either going to be 1%, 2%, 3%, X amount of dollars, X amount of ounces of silver. At some point, there's going to be a catalyst, and its reality is going to set in. So, all right, so I don't want to get ahead of that, because I want to take a break and then get into kind of where we're going. I'm covering the past, getting up to now, and then going to the future. So I would tell my father, I said, you know, you got to get rid of this property. I said, Dad, could you take $25 million right now and sell the property? You know, take a $10 million cut just to, you know, take the deal. He's like, no, I want it all. I want it all. I'm going to get it all. Don't worry about it. Okay. 2007, my baby boomer partner, him and his father wanted to start a bank. Brilliant idea, guys. 2007, everybody's making millions of dollars making banks, right? 2007, sure, loaning out money, fractional reserve lending, you can make a ton of money. So I was invited to like a little conference like this in one of the restaurants that my partners owned. And they had 20 other millionaire baby boomer, you know, their shit didn't stink kind of guys. They were all higher on themselves than I've ever seen any group of people. And they were lawyers, developers, car dealers, you know, just your local millionaire in town. And they all came in with the idea that they were going to pool $1 million apiece and start a bank. So they started Heritage Community Bank in Randolph, New Jersey. And I was invited there under the auspices of me investing $1 million, my father investing $1 million. And I went to the thing, and I knew I was not getting involved in this because no way. I said I sold out of the house. I knew credit cycles. I knew this was a bad idea. So I went there just to kind of experience it. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about being enlightened, that you get to really experience life. You're not in it, so you're not like, oh, you know, what's going on here, and I got to go around here. You start really opening up your mind, and you're like, I get what's going on. I get the overall context of what the meeting is. I get that what that individual's thinking. I get why he believes in this, and I get why he's successful. And you know, you start observing and you start really experiencing life. I think like guys like George Carlin, they really experience life, so much so that they can make fun of life. Because it is. Our whole life is really comical when you think about it. I mean, it's we all follow the same pattern, and yet we're always afraid. And yet our path is probably very safe and normal, and there's really no reason to ever be fearful in your entire life. You know, I look at my kids when they're fearful. You look at them, and you're like, why are you scared? You know, there's nothing wrong here. There's no monster in the room. And yet for them, it's such a real experience. And it's only because you've seen the truth and you've seen the light. You know, a brilliant example of this is, you know, if there's a, and I'll give you another example. When I was in the Marines, it was posted on some training exercise, and here I am, a buck private, sitting out in the middle of the woods, 2 o'clock in the morning, no one around, and I was told that recon Marines were patrolling and trying to get into our area. So when you're right in the infantry school, you know, you're like, you know, you're sitting there, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard, like, some whistling of sounds and stuff. And you think recon Marines are literally ninjas. Like, they can dance on top of trees and, you know, you don't know. I mean, these guys are supposed to be the best of the best. And here I am, just an infantry grunt. So it got so bad that I'm staring off across this road, and I remember it to the day. And you could see, it was not a very bright night, but you could see, like, images of things. And my mind literally started creating people walking towards me. Okay? And I could feel my heartbeat and sweat and, like, I mean, my body was physically reacting to some evil guys coming my way. And I was like, oh, my God. And it got so bad that I had to whip out my flashlight and shine the light. And that's a huge no-no if you're in the Marines, okay? But it was either that or I was going to have a full-on panic attack and just die right there. Because that's how powerful that image was, that fear of the unknown coming towards me. And as soon as I shine that light, you know, there was nothing there. And you're immediately, your brain goes, wow, that's not that big of a deal. So it's always the fear of the unknown that really makes us afraid. And I think what we're trying to do here is to, I've told you guys this story about the horror story. If you've ever seen a horror movie, your scariest horror movie, I remember the Blair Witch Project. I saw that the first time and I was like, oh my God, that's the scariest movie I've ever seen. The reason why you're afraid of the scary movie is not the blood and the knives and stuff. And Blair Witch Project didn't have any of that, quite honestly. There was no violence in the whole movie. But the thing that you were most afraid of is the fear of the unknown, that popping out, the scream, the thing. And as soon as you've seen that movie once, it's not scary again. I remember watching it the second time, and I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty good movie. But man, I remember walking out the first time, I'm like, oh God, you know? I'm never going to the woods again, you know, and here I was in the Marines. And then if you start seeing the behind the scenes of the movie and realizing how the movie was progressed and stuff, you now start looking at this thing that gave you physical, real reactions and start laughing at it because you see the truth of it. Well, it's the same thing that's going on here, okay? We know that there's a horror movie playing out there. We know that there's going to be a massive disruption in our lives, okay? But we're getting rid of that fear of the unknown because it's going to happen, okay? Reality is going to come into one of our days or our time. And the idea is I'm aware and I'll be prepared for it. And it's not even the buying the guns and the gold and the silver and, you know, doing all this stuff. It's the mental thing. That's what's really going to screw up everybody, okay? Food will be available. You know, there's going to be semblance of order throughout most of humanity. That's going to happen. What people are going to waste decades on are, why did this happen? How did I lose everything? You know, you look at the Bernie Madoff victims. These were the richest, most powerful families. I mean, there was this one French family that was 200 years, go back to King Louis, you know, multimillionaire people. And this guy ended up killing himself because he couldn't deal with the reality. He was unprepared for it. And it was too scary for him to even think about going forward. So I'm at this meeting with all these bankers, or new-to-be bankers, and, you know, they're cognac and cigars, and we're so smart, and, you know, you don't understand. And my partner comes up to me, and I never liked him. and he never liked me. But we were dealer's sons. He dropped out of college. What? Yeah. Whatever. To each his own. So he came up to me and, you know, he says, so are you in? I said, no. And he said, I tried to wuss out of it and say, I don't have the money. And he said, well, your father can, you know, front you the money and you just, you know, owe him. And I'd be like, yeah. And then he pressed me on the thing because now I sense like he was like, you know, what's the matter? Not big enough, you know. So I said, you know what? I said, I think what you're doing is stupid. I said, I think all you guys are going to end up losing all your money. I said, we're at the end of a credit collapse. I said, I sold my house in 2005. I've asked you guys to sell the properties. I said, now you want to start a bank and leverage yourself and your capital on properties that are already overvalued, and you guys think you're going to make money? I'm 30 years old in a group of 50, 60, 70-year-old millionaires, okay? That's the kind of tone that I used on him. So I basically, from that point, that ruined that relationship. I mean, that was like... Because here I am at his little party, and you know, he pushed me. And, you know, I'm a nice guy, but don't corner me. Don't ever corner anybody, because they'll end up coming at you. You know, if somebody's trying to be playful, let them go, you know. Don't corner them. So that's what he ended up doing with me, and I lost that relationship with him. My daughter was born, and we had an argument with my mom. And, again, you guys will not understand this. But you've met my wife. She's a wonderful lady, and my mom is complete opposite. I mean, just complete opposite. Bulldog. Yeah, if you could picture a bulldog. I'm going to tell you one story. I was at a construction site with her in high school, so 92. She's 5 foot maybe, right? 100 pounds maybe. Blonde hair, blue eyes, very fair skin. And she ran a general construction site, so she would be the general contractor. You know, most general contractors are big, tough guys and, you know, all this other stuff. She was this thing. So we bought a dealership in Jersey City. Jersey City is a very old-school Italian mobbed-up town, okay? And we were partners with the DeFeos, who were very, very wealthy. And I think they were on the legit, but who knows? So we bought this dealership, and my mom brings in all of her suburban, non-union construction guys that she worked with out in the suburbs with us. And we had two electricians there and me. And so I'm jackhammering inside this thing, and my mom's gone, and the two electricians are over there doing their thing, and I stop, and the whole room's full of dust, and I got, like, black boogers coming out of my nose. It's just a mess. But I'm 18, so what does that matter? So I'm outside and I hear my mom talking at this tone. And, so I go outside and there's three big dudes there and they're standing around her and, you know, I'm 6 foot and these guys were 6'4" at least. I mean, they were just big, massive men. And, I walk up and I know my mom. All right. I knew that she could handle herself. So I listen in on the conversation. So now I got a hammer in my hands. I'm covered in just dirt. And I'm probably about, I don't know, 10 feet away from her as she's talking to these guys. And I pick up on the tone. The conversation's already progressed. And basically the tone of the situation was these guys were to nicely to let her know that what she was doing was not going to happen. Jersey City was a little different. You have to use our workers. You know, you're going to need about 10 guys to do what these two guys are doing right now, and we can start tomorrow. And my mom was like, uh-uh. She started getting to a point where she yelled so loud that somebody ended up calling the cops. She was like, you guys are all a bunch of crooked scumbags, and she'd be dropping F-bombs and, you know, all this other stuff, and going to the face and foam spitting out of her mouth, and her face would get the color of that red sweater, just vein popping, bulging. But it got so bad that somebody called the cops, thinking that these three guys were beating up on my mom. So this young patrol officer comes up onto the scene and, you know, separates the men. Okay, guys, come on over here, over here. And my mom is you know, now starting to calm down, stuff like that. And the officer turns around and comes to her and she says, you know, what's the problem? And she goes, well, these three guys, you know, are trying to intimidate me on the site. And he goes, well, they're not trying to intimidate you. They're just trying to talk to you. And she goes, are you on the hook too? You guys are all a bunch of scumbags. And, then she starts attacking the cop. So I'm watching this, and now I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I got, like, mob guys, some cops. My mom's going nuts. I got a hammer. Yeah, like, I just like, Mom, come on. Right. So the on-duty chief comes down. So now I got a crowd of people. There's probably about, you know, 10, 20 other people around. These three guys, the officer and the sergeant on duty, comes down to the scene. And, again, now the my mom's still yelling, the sergeant comes down. This is going on for 20 minutes. I mean, can you imagine arguing that long? My mom gets off on it. She's like nuclear power. Like, you set her off, and she'll just nuclear vibrate all over the place. And I grew up around that. I mean, I know what it's like to argue. I mean, I had arguments with her 8 hours. Can you imagine arguing with somebody at the top of your lungs for 8 hours? Sweating, both of you. I have it in me, trust me. So the police officer comes down, the sergeant on the deck, and he, a much older, wiser gentleman, starts coming in, and he realized what was going on, calmed my mom down and said, these guys will not be around your site anymore. Don't worry about it, Mrs. Duane. Go ahead. And that was the end of it. But that shows you this kind of fire that, you know, my mom has. But when it came to her, she ain't like her at all. In fact, she's about opposite as you could get. And I think that's why I was attracted to her so much, because I didn't want that kind of violence in my life. I mean, it's just, you can't sleep at night. I mean, it's just your whole world is like that. So when we were dating, they were good friends. When we got engaged, things started to change. When we got married, things got bad. When we had a child, that was it. And the more I progressed with her, the worse the relationship got with my mom, because she was the opposite. She didn't vibrate with her at all. She loved fire. You know, that's what they did. They fire. Oh, yeah. And we did all the nice things. We wanted to, you know, play nice and do the right thing. We were always the, you know, the good couple that would show up to their whatever. Meanwhile, my sister is like, fuck you, Ma. I ain't doing that shit. Meanwhile, she's the one that's still living at the house and doing all that other stuff. So we ended up having our daughter, Katie Scarlett, and we didn't see my mom from, like, the wedding. We got pregnant. She was there for the birth. Like, she came, and it was all about her. Like, oh, let me hold my granddaughter, you know. And then she didn't want to talk to her parents. Yeah, started arguing with my sister-in-law or whatever. So then came the christening. I'm like, all right. And again, this is a lesson to if identify social predators in your life and cut them out immediately, okay? Just, I don't care what it takes, just do it, because you'll end up wasting so much time of your life. So again, we're always trying to do the right thing. You know, okay, maybe they just don't understand. So we get done with the christening, newly baptized, first grandchild of the whole thing. My wife, being as good as she is, walks directly over to my mom as a peace offering, basically, brings my daughter to her. And what does my mom do? Like this, to my daughter, and walked out of the church. Can you imagine that? Okay, that kind of gives you the little thing that went on there. So that ended my relationship with my mom immediately. I needed to see that. I needed to see my mom reject my daughter for that to happen. But I always held that hope for my father, because I saw the good in him. Darth Vader's over there, and I see the good in him. And he was a good guy. I mean, I can't help but to think, had he not met my mom, he probably would not have been as successful. I don't think so at all, because she was definitely the fire in his pot. But he would have been a happier guy. You know, he was a very smart guy. He was one of the fastest promoted executives at General Motors history. I think by the time he was 33, he was the vice president of the New York zone. So he was a really sharp guy. But I always held out hope that he, you know, would do the right thing one day and stand by me or do, you know, whatever. And, so I spent from 2007 now, because I had cut off the relationship with my mom, and when was Katie born? 05. I lost contact with my sister in 08 or like my partner in 07 at the bank thing, and then now is my father. My father was the only reason why I was staying around in that business, because I thought I was reaching to him, because he was the most receptive of all the people I talked to about all this stuff. And I realize now he was just placating me because he needed me to run the business, because that's all I did was run the business for him. And so 2008 came around, and now my spidey sense is going off. I'm like, all right, I know I've been telling you the last 3 years that this market's going to collapse, but it's really going to collapse now. I feel it so deep that I can't believe that it hasn't happened yet. So in May of 2005, I told my wife, I said, I got a letter from my mom that said my sister cheated on her husband. Now, this is very personal shit, but I want you to know where I come from. My sister cheated on her husband, and they're getting a divorce. My mom pushed for that divorce. She didn't push for them to get back together. She pushed for the divorce. The day that my sister signed the divorce papers, my mom left a note on my desk at work that said, "Leave Dora now before she totally destroys you." I needed to see that again. And I realized at this point, I could no longer do what I was doing, be involved in this world at all on any level, because now it was my child, my wife, me. I couldn't handle it anymore. So I took that letter. I went into my father's office. I said, "You have to take care of this right now." I said, "Either I leave or you get divorced, because I'm not living with her anymore and I'm not participating in this anymore. And I'm the only son of this multi-million-dollar empire." And I basically had the idea that a good guy would say, "Okay, you own $2.5 million worth of property and assets and stuff. Here's some money and, you know, go have a good life." I was given the ultimatum right back immediately: "You'll get nothing and you can leave whenever you want." Fair enough. Shook his hand and that was it. That was the end of my relationship with my father. Like that. Okay? That's probably the best moment of my life. And I'll tell you, no matter how bad any of your things are that you have going on in your life, your only job is to deal with that bad thing, is just to keep moving forward. Okay? Because I'll tell you, I don't care how bad, I've gone through a lot of bad stuff in my life. Your only job is to deal with that thing and move on the best you can. And the only thing you can do is just keep moving towards that truth, that spark, that reality, that light, because eventually you'll come to a day like this. To me, this is a very happy day for me. I like being with people who do resonate and get this type of stuff. So here I left, walked away from $2.5 million, you know, signed these papers. I don't even know what they meant or anything as a lawyer. I don't know what it is, but I haven't gotten any tax bills or anything like that. And I basically moved. And oh, by the way, my wife's pregnant again while I do this. 6 or 7 months pregnant with my son, Jack. And we didn't tell them about her being pregnant because I didn't want any more stress on her. Because the first time around was very stressful on her. I mean, first time pregnancy, going through all this thing, and you know, you're getting fat and big, and yet your mother-in-law hates you, and breaking up families and doing all this stuff. So we didn't tell our parents that. And so I left New Jersey. Thank God we had... I negotiated with my father to get, 4 months of health care? That was my big going away present, 4 months of health care, just for his grandchild to be born. So we had our child in June of 2008, and then we moved to Ohio. We moved out here, okay? So this is a pretty cool area because I used to make fun of her. I said, Cleveland, do you guys still make your own butter out there? And like... Oh, yeah. That's one thing I was big on. I'll never. Everything was I'll never, you know, because I was a big mouth. I knew exactly where I was, you know, when I was 20 years old. I'll never, 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 never. I was too tight. And when it came time for us to run away, you know, I looked at Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, you know, all the typical runaway spots that, you know, if you don't have anything going on, you know, where could you go? So when I started talking to, you can bring it in. We got food and sandwiches and stuff. So when we looked at, God, has there already been? Man, I can talk. you guys enjoying this so far? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So when we moved here, I came at a very bad time because the only reason why I was able to leave is because I had invested all my money into silver at $7.50. And silver was at $21 when I put my big foot down and I said, you know, I'm leaving. So it was easy for me to leave financially. It was hard for me to leave emotionally, intellectually. I mean, who walks away from, you know, that type of life? I mean, being where I was, it was very difficult. And I realized after I left, that was the collective's way, the paradigm trying to keep me inside of their control. His estate plan, his, you know, all these regulate, you know, all these things that he had designed for me weren't to benefit me at all. They were designed to make me his slave for the next 30 years as I paid off these millions of dollars worth of debt. So yeah, I was worth, you know, $2.5 million at one point, but I owed him $30 million. That's a great estate plan for him, wasn't it? Would you do that to your kid? Load your kid up with as much debt as possible and have him work it out? I wouldn't. I'd rather leave him a bunch of bars. That's what I plan on doing. So when I woke up to this, I was like, wow, I really have been sacrificing everything that I am, everything for me, for something that doesn't resonate with me in order to benefit somebody else. I'm never doing that again. I don't care what happens to me. I'm never doing that again. Because I ended up wasting, you know, 10 years of my, you know, you think I got energy now. I'm 37. I'm probably 20 pounds heavier than I was back then. I was a real hard charger back then. And I realized I wasted all that time and energy, and I probably could have done something very special had I had the right direction, had I been aware that what I was doing was chasing after something that was never there, both in money, businesses, relationships, you know, location. None of that mattered. I mean, none of it. This is about all I have to show for my nice, fancy car dealer suit. I got my nice, you know, watch and stuff. But this stuff means nothing to me. I don't care about this. What have I been wearing the last 3 years? Jeans and T-shirts. So when I moved out here, that was 08. Well, what happened to silver in 08? Were you guys involved in silver back then? Went from $21 to $8. Pretty big takedown, 60%. And this is all the money I had. That was it. Now I had a new house out here, two car payments, no health insurance, no job, two kids, moving expenses, all that other stuff. Yeah, emotion of breaking up with my family, walking away from all the friends that I had ever known, walking away from the only business I had ever known, walking away from my family's fortune, walking away from my family, walking away from everything, and let's throw on top of it losing 60% of your wealth in 6 months. Pretty tough time, huh? It sucked, didn't it? And then we move here in September, okay, get settled in. October, I go out looking for a job. Car business. I was a car dealer. I can get a job in the car business, right? I'm young. I'm smart. I know all this stuff, right? So October happens. Boom. Stock market collapses. So silver has already gone down from March down to the time we moved in. I think September, October was like that $8 bottom down there. So I just lost a ton of wealth, walked away from everything. Now I go to look for a job to make some money, right? Because I don't want to sell my bullion. I never want to sell that. So I've been burning through all the dollar savings that I had, and I go out to look for a job. Well, the stock market collapsed. All these car dealers, everything that I've been predicting happened. So I walked in, and my first interview was with a guy I had established communications with, was in the Lions Club with somebody. He had a couple of car dealerships. I figured, he seems like a nice guy. I wanted to go talk to him. I walked in, and he's got CNBC on going, oh, my God, I think I just lost everything. That was my interview. That was my hope to get a job coming out here. Okay? And he did. He ended up in Coltonstein. He ended up losing everything. So for 4 months, I busted my ass. Okay? Can you imagine me on an interview? I think I'm pretty persuasive. I can talk my way into just about anything. And I could not get a job for the life of me out here. Couldn't. No one, I mean, I could not hire. So I ended up taking a job selling cars at Pat O'Brien in Medina, just selling cars. And it was no salary, no nothing. You know, work 60 hours a week, shoveling the snow off there. Because I needed something just to stop spinning. I told my wife, I said, I'll push brooms. I don't care. I cannot think about this anymore. I can't think about my family. I can't think about the money. I can't think about anything. I just need to work. I need to do something. So I started just selling cars again. And I was trying so hard to stay inside this paradigm, this car dealer paradigm, that I'm like, all right, I'm pushing for something that's obviously not there. Okay, what is there? I said, what are my talents and abilities? So then I started thinking, well, I have a lot of transferable talents. I could, you know, do financial stuff. I'm pretty good with, you know, smarts. Too bad silver went down. So I started looking at financial planning, and then I realized this doesn't resonate with me either. I went out to Northwestern Mutual. They loved me at Northwestern Mutual. They go, oh, you're the kind of guy we need. Come on, we're going to fly you to Chicago. So I met this one guy for 2 hours. They flew me out to Chicago for their national meeting. Luxury trip. I got my own room, you know, all this stuff. And they're feeding you full of Kool-Aid. Like, you know, we have insurance policies. We're financial planning. We're strong, you know, all this other stuff. And it was just, I mean, Jim Jones didn't have anything as, you know, as good as these guys. I mean, you just, and you're like, yeah, this is great. Meanwhile, it was just a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it's just a huge Ponzi scheme. And those at the top, they needed a lot of young guys out there to go pound the flesh, to go get their neighbors and relatives and stuff, to go sell them, you know, all these financial products. And you look at the way the commissions are set up. Your first year that you pay any insurance, all of it is profit to these guys. Not $1 goes to your insurance policy. And after that, it's a Ponzi scheme. The more money that they get in, fine, they got some payments out, but man, they're getting a lot of money in. Okay, so that didn't resonate with me, and I didn't go anywhere with that. And we ended up, I gave up. I said, God, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but I give up. I said, whatever you got planned for me, I give up. That moment was a very important moment, and I hope that if you guys ever run into that, give up. Stop pushing for whatever you think that is out there. Give up. Just let it out there. And what ended up happening with Lisa?
I'm going to go. She called me up and said, my husband Josh has a small, you know, some sort of office position for me. And I was like, I'll take it. Anything. I don't care. Chris could be home with the kids or whatever it is. So I go in and I meet this guy, Josh. Super nice guy. The most positive person you'll ever meet in your life.
Yeah, he's a very
super nice guy. And he's like, tell me about your story. And I actually kind of nutshelled what Chris just told you guys. So I nutshelled it, and he went, yeah, I don't need you. I need him. I'm like, great. I don't want to work anyway. Oh, wait, my baby's new. And I have a 3-year-old, and then I have a newborn. So I'm, you know, still trying to get back into myself, you know, after having babies. So you're just kind of like, so he's like, yeah. He didn't hear a word I said. He's just,
yeah,
like,
as soon as he, like,
I want to meet Chris. And I like, indirectly told him about Chris. I wasn't like, yeah, Chris did this. And da, 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 da. It was like, yeah, we did this. Oh, and by the way, he did this. Da, da, da. And then it was, oh, and by the way, he did that. You know, and he's like, oh, my God, tell me more. It, like, glue on this guy.
So as soon as I let go,
yeah.
I mean, how do you have somebody, 15 years, they haven't seen each other. Both of our kids are born one day apart.
Mm-hmm.
They immediately clicked. She goes to talk to him, and then immediately I have a job within, I mean, literally it was within a week
overnight.
Or so. I mean, it was,
yeah.
You can't make that stuff
up.
Fell in
love with him. Yeah.
And I walked into this job. Thank you.
Sure. Well, so, we're going to take a break in 2 minutes.
Yeah, I'm just getting up to where we are. Thank you, Dora. So as soon as I gave up, boom, and now I got a job. And it was a decent paying job. I was making 6 figures for this guy. And again, I had no idea about internet marketing. I had no idea about all this other stuff. But this path started to become aware to me because I didn't care anything about foreclosed investment. I still believe, like, Ponzi, like, you know, I like the idea that we were teaching individuals how to clean up a big collective mess because the government wasn't going to figure it out. The banks weren't going to figure it out. I was going to take individual investors to go appraise the house, find out what it's worth, see if they buy it low, and then, you know, retail it out. And we taught people how to do that, and that was a great thing. And then we developed a group where other people would help other people learn all the same stuff. And it was a great time going, but at the end of the day, I was like, I think that the reason why I'm here is not to help people foreclosure investing, is because the idea of communicating ideas on blogs and teaching people through video, that resonates with me. I said, wow, I got all this great information that I learned, this really powerful stuff, and nobody else out there has put it together. I said, I could do that. So what did I do? I put together a PowerPoint presentation of 1,776 PowerPoint slides. You know, I hear people bitching about, oh, my buddy's a drug rep. And he's like, yeah, I got to put together this 30 PowerPoint presentation. And it's taking, and I'm like, dude, I said, I put together 1,776 PowerPoint presentation, and it encompasses all of history, all the financial knowledge that you'll ever need, emotional, spiritual, you know, health. I put it all together in order, and, you know, I for free. And I started putting together this big PowerPoint presentation to put together a process that people can go through awakening and learn all the same stuff that I had learned without reading 240 books, without having to put all these pieces together, without having to do all this stuff, and put it into one storyline. So the Sons of Liberty Academy ended up coming out of this, and I literally recorded it while I'm working, you know, 60 hours a week for Josh on weekends. I'd be up at every recorded thing you heard was probably recorded at 4 o'clock in the morning before my kids got up. Everything on the Sons of Liberty Academy in the basement, dark. Yeah, I looked like Gollum from Lord of the Rings. I was down there, my precious, you know, building this academy, and I had no idea what it was like. You know, the skills of putting together the PowerPoint presentation itself is pretty cool. You know, I did all the graphics and, you know, the things, and but I ended up putting that together, and I had no idea what to do with it. So I did what Josh did. I tried selling it. So, you know, I put the academy out there, and I'm like, in my mind, this is easily worth $2,000, because I look at what Josh was selling for his stuff, and I'm like, he sold these information products, which were like 18 videos and a couple PowerPoint presentations, and it was $2,000. And people were like throwing money at him. Oh, we're going to be really millionaire real estate guys. And they were throwing money at him. And we'd have events with like 300 or 400 people there, and everybody's going, Josh, you're the great. Oh, this girl. I'm like, this stuff is far more important. It has made me much more money and has brought me peace and meaning in my life. This has got to be worth $2,000. So then I'm like, well, maybe that's a little too expensive because people don't know what I am. This is kind of a big idea. So I said, well, let's try $177. So I did that, and we had a couple people. There was probably about 100 people that bought it at that. And I realized that this is great. Everybody, I never had one refund on any people that went through the academy. And I'm like, well, that's great. And then I was like, but this isn't resonating with me. This isn't what I'm doing. And that's when I took that leap of faith. I don't know if you guys had seen that. But I ended up leaving my job, six-figure job, because that didn't resonate with me anymore. I ended up giving away my life's work. You try putting in the amount of effort that I put into that academy and then go give it away for free, you know, and quit your job because you believe in it so much. And that's what I ended up doing. Again, something completely insane. I walk away from $2.5 million from my family's business, then move and sell my house, all these insane things. And yet these are the most important things in my life. And I'm so much so that you guys came all the way over here to hear this stuff, because this is important stuff. This is what your life should be about. This is what living life is, okay? So I ended up giving away all this work and energy that I put into this project, and wow, you know, it's been, I don't know how long, it's been 9 months since we've done that, and I really feel for the first time in my life, I'm really living life. I mean, I feel so privileged to be here. I love getting up. I like doing what I'm doing, so much so that, you know, we came out here today, and what we're going to do is we're going to eat. I'm going to take a break. I got to relax a little because I get a little pumped up. And then we'll talk about where we're going to go from here, because I think that I have a good idea of where we're going. You know, I could put out ideas all day long, but I think at the end of the day, it's all going to be us individually sparking with each other, sparking with other people, and helping humanity not try to change the outside world to make them free, but to make us free, to make the outside world free.
Chris, the one thing I'd love to know is, do we at least see where everyone's from?
Yeah. Actually, how about this? Why don't we go get eat, and then when we come back, we'll go around the room, and then you know, everybody says their little name and 2-minute speech, and we'll start up after that. Okay.
Thanks.
Yep. Well, I know we got, you're probably my guest for the longest drive so far. Iowa. Yep. You, what was it?
$118
round trip. Oh, yeah, that's cheap.
And I'd spend more on gas.
Yeah.
Save a lot of time. Oh, yeah, I'm Jeff.
I'm Sean.
What's up, Sean? How are you? Where are you from?
Detroit area.
Oh, nice. Fly or drive?
Drove.
How long's that one?
3 hours.
No, that's not terrible.
Okay. What was your first shower?
That's about...